Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, more farmers are having to find off-farm jobs to cover their costs. We'll take a closer look at what farm families are doing to make it work. A state lawmaker discusses efforts to protect a major source of drinking water. We'll head to the town of Morton, where pumpkin processing is a key part of that town's identity. A visiting professor from Gaza discusses the difficulty in leaving his homeland. We'll also introduce you to a tattoo artist who is helping women who have undergone mastectomies. We'll hear a reporter's thoughts on the recent election, and we'll also look ahead to the anniversary of Illinois becoming a state and what happened to Native American tribes who called Illinois home. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. You might have an image of a farmer in their tractor or with a bucket feeding livestock, but the reality is farmers can often be found in office cubicles, driving school buses, or even stocking shelves. That's become much more common over the past few decades. Today, more than 85% of farm families rely on off-farm income. As Teresa Homsey reports, that's because farmers often need another part-time or even a full-time job just to stay in business.
The Leelanau Peninsula, known as Michigan's Pinky, extends for 30 miles into Lake Michigan. The rolling hills and lake's insulating effect makes this place ideal for growing fruit. Cherry farmer Phil Halstead says the landscape never gets old, but growing cherries is becoming more difficult.
I don't go to Vegas because I gamble every year. Cherries are so, so risky.
After several tough years, Halstead has transitioned his farm to a U-pick model, where people pay to harvest their own cherries. He also plans to cash in on the region's tourist economy by opening campsites on his land. Halstead says his family made those changes after years of working part-time jobs and still struggling to make ends meet.
2 years ago, I was ready to throw in the towel, and my wife said, I'm not. And I love my wife, and I follow my wife. And so it was like, okay, I got to figure this out. So together, we're trying this new business model.
Only 37% of farmers held a primary job off the farm in 1974. Today, roughly 85% of family farmers rely on other jobs to support their livelihoods. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack says the increasing dependence on off-farm income is causing more and more small farms to sell.
So the question I think we ask ourselves is simply, why is it that the farm family has to work multiple jobs? Why can't the farm work harder and generate more farm income?
Profit margins are thinner for small farmers. The cost of inputs like seed, fertilizer, and labor have generally gone up, while prices for ag products are lower. Agricultural economist Daniel Munch with the American Farm Bureau says competing in a global market means farmers have to keep scaling up.
We're never in the position of saying it's bad that farms are getting bigger, right? They're just doing it because that's what they need to survive in the marketplace we have now, which is a harsh reality.
In Nebraska, Vern Jansen grows corn and soybeans and sells to a local co-op. He says the good news is that he's debt-free, but he likely won't break even from his crops this year.
With an average yield and a below average price, it doesn't pencil out.
Jansen is also a substitute bus driver. While initially it wasn't for the extra income, now he says he's glad to have the job. He says farming is like college football in Nebraska.
We have had a terrible time for many, many years. But the thing that keeps us going as football fans is there's always next year. And that's, I think, what keeps a lot of farmers going. There's always next year.
While farmers are used to the ups and downs, some are exploring ways to generate more income from their goods. That could help small and mid-sized farmers diversify and survive, says Jay Arbuckle, an Iowa State University sociologist.
You know, differentiating, adding value to a product is a way to earn a price premium. Berries, turn them into jam, or pigs, turn them into ham. Adding a second or third crop that has more local market or a more niche market.
Or if it's an option, farmers can turn to agritourism, like Phil Halstead in Michigan. He points to an area where visitors will soon be able to set up campsites.
So we have a platform overlooking down below.
Even if cherries don't pay, Halstead says he doesn't want to see local orchards sliced up and turned into subdivisions.
Once that house goes up, it's gone. It will always be housing. We're trying to avoid that. We love this land, and the land is special.
Halstead says in order to preserve farmland, we need to ensure farmers can stay in business. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Teresa Holmesy.
Homeless encampments are now prohibited in Peoria. That's after the city council there narrowly voted to enact the ban this past week. The vote saw the council choose an option that includes possible jail terms for multiple offenses. Council member Zach Euler was among those voting in favor.
These conventions and concerts will cease. The restaurants will cease because they will struggle to survive. The businesses will not survive here.
Members opposed to the ban say it criminalizes homelessness and doesn't help the unhoused individuals who need assistance. Other communities are looking at similar plans. Springfield briefly considered a proposal, but it was tabled after an outcry from some community members. The founder of the Illinois Tattoo Company in Bloomington offers help to women dealing with breast cancer. Chad Ramsey offers nipple reconstruction tattooing to women who've undergone mastectomies, using his artistry to recreate what's been lost. In this audio postcard, Ramsey says it started about 7 or 8 years ago.
We were just getting ready to close for the day, and a lady walked in. She was crying, she was visibly upset, and she had just found out that she had cancer, and she felt the need to get a tattoo. So I ended up doing like a little cross on her, and it was just really, it was pretty emotional, you know, like she was, like I said, she was upset. It sort of made me, you know, upset. So I did the tattoo, and I didn't end up charging her for it. I just said, you know, hopefully it'll just get you through whatever it is you're gonna be going through. Maybe 2 years later, she came walking through the door and she was like, hey, I just want to say thanks for that because it really got me through it and it was difficult. And it just sort of made me think like, man, these people, you know, they go through hell and then they're stuck with something that, you know, they're not necessarily happy with. Some people feel like they're missing part of their womanhood or they're disfigured in some way. And I just thought, man, you know, I know I can do it. So I just started offering it. You know, I had people come in asking for it, and now I have like a few clinics that refer me to their clients. So I don't do a ton of them, but I think it's, for some people, it's something that they either offer it in the hospital, and it's like in a setting where whoever's performing it isn't really doing the best job, or maybe doesn't have their best interests in mind. They're just sort of putting something on there. Whereas, you know, I'll sit down and really try and make it so it's as natural looking as possible. But so far, it's been great. Oddly enough, I guess I sort of treat it like a portrait because most of them either have like, maybe they still have one, so I just match that one. Or they'll have an old photo, or they'll bring in a photo of another set that they like. It's sort of really up to them. But that's basically how I treat it, is almost like a portrait. There's one in my portfolio there of that particular client. They had tried to create a nipple, and it was sort of lopsided. So I was able to do a little bit of shading around it to make it look more round and more natural. I mean, it's been great. Yeah, I mean, so far, I've had some too that don't necessarily do a nipple. They've done like something like floral. I've had a couple of them say, you know, they've had that for years and they didn't really care to have it again and they wanted something cooler. So we just don't do a nipple necessarily, but it's definitely something that is not for artists with not so much experience. I mean, I've been tattooing for 27 years. I feel like I kind of know how the colors will heal, how they'll settle, the tones, and what the client would just expect once it's all said and done. If it's something that somebody is thinking of having done, they're more than welcome to contact me. I can send them photos of healed tattoos, and I mean, they're welcome to listened to their doctor as far as the referrals go. I'm sure they have a whole list of options, whether it be in-house or, you know, in a studio setting. But I feel like most people, like the last one I tattooed, I think she just felt a lot more comfortable not being in a doctor's office. You know, like music's playing, everybody's laughing, sort of a different environment. It's not so depressing. You know, if it's something that anybody is interested in, I'm happy to sit down and talk to them, talk about options, and if I can help you out, I'd be happy to.
Chad Ramsey is founder of the Illinois Tattoo Company in Bloomington. He provides a service to women dealing with breast cancer who have undergone mastectomies. So much of what we hear about life in Gaza comes secondhand. A deal with student protesters could change that for members of the Northwestern University community. The agreement that ended the pro-Palestinian encampment last spring is bringing two professors and five students from Gaza to the Evanston campus. Lisa Curry and Phillip has the story of one of the professors who arrived recently after leaving his entire life behind.
My name is Mkhaymar Abu Saada. I know my first name is very difficult. Even in our society, it's not a very common name.
Abu Saada is small in stature. When I meet him, he's dressed in a tweed blazer and dotted maroon tie. What really catches my eye is his broad, whole-faced smile. It's framed by layers of dimples and crow's feet. He's turning 60 this month. Abu Saada's wife, children, and mother are back in Egypt, where they evacuated from Gaza last November. So he's on his own here in Evanston. He says he's trying to adjust.
One thing I should be doing, I should be cooking, but I just don't like to do that.
We sit down in an office he's borrowing from a Northwestern professor who's on sabbatical. The one he was initially offered was empty, but this one is filled with books he's hoping to read. The conflict that brought him to this office is the latest chapter in a long history, one that inspired him to become a political scientist.
Look, I was born and grew in a place where it's everything is politics. Back in 1948, when Israel declared independence, my father and my mother were expelled from their villages. That's the beginning of our stories.
His parents settled in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. That's where Abu Saada was born and raised, and where he participated in what he calls his first political activity.
When we were in high school, what we used to do is to throw stones at or bricks at the Israeli army. This is a part of what Palestinian resistance was back then. I ended up getting jailed for a week for doing that activity.
He eventually left to complete graduate degrees in political science in the U.S., but he says he missed his parents and siblings intensely during his time here.
Right after that, I went home. I went back to Gaza with my wife and two children who were born in the U.S. I've been teaching at Al-Azhar University in Gaza for the past 27 years, and I think 27. Yeah.
Abu Saada says raising a family in Gaza was not easy. He and his wife have three sons and two daughters. Electricity was spotty. Healthcare wasn't great. He remembers when his little daughter was in constant fear because of military tension and escalation. But Abu Saada says all that was nothing compared to what began last year on October 7th.
My wife came and woke me up and said, you know, something big is happening. Because there were rockets being fired against Israel. And whenever rockets are being fired, you can hear the noise.
Abu Saada and his wife turned on the TV and eventually saw that Hamas fighters had crossed into Israel with pickup trucks and machine guns and taken over whole communities there.
I knew that it's not going to be an easy situation. I mean, the attack that Hamas carried on October 7th, killing 1,200 Israelis and taking hostages, it's not going to be we're going to be subjected to severe Israeli retaliation, but not to what is happening now.
Abu Saada and his family sheltered in his brother's home after they were told to leave their neighborhood. But a few days later, Israel issued another order. All Gazans in the north must leave for the south.
At the first moment, I didn't want to leave. I thought this is just, you know, where to go? I mean, take your wife and kids, and where do you want to go? We always remember the first Palestinian Nakba, and we have always blamed our fathers and grandfathers, why did you leave? I was thinking to myself, people look at me as a role model. If I leave, I mean, who's going to stay? But then this is what happened. My brother's apartment looks over a main street in Gaza called Al-Rashid Street, which connects Gaza from the north all the way to the south. And from the early hours of that morning, you can see thousands of Palestinians packing their personal stuff and leaving to the south. So my wife and kids, they came to me and they said, look, people are leaving. If we don't leave, we might just die.
Abu Sada does not think they will ever be able to go back. His university has been all but destroyed. He has many relatives among the more than 42,000 Palestinians killed. His siblings and their families have been scattered. He says they'll never again gather for a shared meal at his mother's home. Abu Sada says he's grateful to be at Northwestern. He can earn money to send to his family in Egypt. He's researching and writing about the conflict. He's taking time to see old friends he made when he was first here for graduate school. And he's walking.
I love to walk by the lake, maybe for one simple reason. It reminds me with Gaza's beach. That's what I used to do when I was in Gaza, that I didn't live very far away from the beach. So, you know, this is part of soul healing, I guess.
He thinks constantly of all the people left behind in Gaza, relatives and friends, the 650,000 children who can't go to school, he says. During his time here, he hopes he can be their voice, the voice of the forgotten Palestinians, he says, to anyone who will listen. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
We've got more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. December 3rd will be the 206th anniversary of Illinois becoming a state. The Illinois State Historical Society is marking the occasion with a symposium in Springfield. Several speakers will be discussing the history of Illinois. One of those is Michael Wyant. He is Director Emeritus at the Illinois State Museum, Dixon Mounds. He'll be speaking about Native Americans in Illinois in 1818, when we were granted statehood, and he joins us for a preview. So take us back to that time more than 200 years ago. We still had Native American population here in Illinois and what we know as Illinois. What was happening at that time as many were trying to move towards statehood?
It was an extraordinary time of transition. American settlers were moving in from the Ohio River Valley primarily, but tribal people still held large swaths of Illinois territory, especially the upper two-thirds of it. It was a tumultuous time in United States history. The War of 1812 had only recently been settled. Some of the tribes had sided with the British under the promise that they would be able to retain their lands taken through treaty by the United States. The difficulties that occurred at Prophetstown in northwestern Indiana, with the Prophet's Village being overtaken, a movement of tribal people into the Lake Peoria region. It was a time of tension that occurred. And then between 1801 and 1809, William Henry Harrison, the territorial governor appointed by Thomas Jefferson to negotiate treaties with the tribes, completed a sweeping set of treaties that would transfer the bulk of Illinois into the hands of the federal government, away from the hands of the tribes.
I'm assuming that these were not the most fair treaties to the Native Americans, but why did they go along with them? And maybe give us an example of a couple.
It's a complicated problem. I think the tribes, in many ways, didn't think that the transfer of a piece of property was part of their worldview. We're talking about Mother Earth comes into competition with English common law. And so the notion that you could sit down with people and say, we're going to give you this piece of property and sign a piece of paper which had certain stipulations about occupation and hunting rights and their and annuities that would be provided, I don't think was well within the understanding of tribal people to what was going on. Even though treaties had been negotiated, even in some cases by them, by tribal people around them, my notion is that it was still not a clear understanding. In fact, Black Sparrow Hawk himself, after the Treaty of 1804, which is signed in November by a group of Sac and Fox in St. Louis, when the representatives come back, he says something to the effect, how could you give away the land in which my ancestors are buried? And it caused a great deal of commotion among the Sac and Fox, as an example. Meanwhile, the Illinois, who had been located in the upper reaches of the Illinois River, now residing on the lower reaches down near Kaskaskia, in their negotiations of the treaty, an interesting stipulation is that they wanted to be provided a church and a priest because many of them had converted to Catholicism. So the dynamics of it, the understanding of property, the aspects of treaties, it's a very complicated process in which people, United States in particular, have clear designs for territory. And the tribes are in a chaotic state in some ways.
People probably understand that, statehood 206 years ago for Illinois, but people were here, including white settlers, much earlier than that. The French, we know about the French occupations of different parts of Illinois, relationship with Native American tribes.
The French had a very collaborative relationship. Now, they may have had designs, economic designs on it, but it was a very collaborative relationship. And the tribes are drawn to French settlements for the opportunities of trade, to acquire European goods, which were life-transforming. Metal kettles, for example, become a staple, replacing the earthenware vessels that Native people had been making for two millennia. Firearms are another part of it. The exchange of pelts for these European goods was an economy that the French depended on and encouraged entrepreneurs and others to move into Illinois. So initially, at least, these relationships appear to be beneficial. Some of the other relationships were not particularly good, especially where territory was being consumed. And when the pressures of American expansion became even more acute, especially after the War of 1812, the tribes are literally at the front edge of an expansion, and they are not happy about it, and they express their disappointment to Indian agents that are representing their interest. But it appears to be an inexorable expansion.
Basically, the movement of the United States, not just in Illinois, but even westward, they weren't going to be able to stop this. This was just a tidal wave that was coming through, and they were caught up in it.
Yes. I think there are two points to make there that are noteworthy. One is that in his presidential address in something like 1796, George Washington, noting that some of the early treaties has a stipulation that Native people can seek redress for violations of the treaty by members of the public and receive financial reparation, notes is in his address that he fears that the U.S. Treasury will soon become bankrupt as a result of the onslaught of transgressions made by settlers. The other one that's noteworthy is that Jefferson finds himself in a difficult position because the colonists are hanging literally to the eastern seaboard. The English are still in Canada. He has designs on expanding the U.S. to strengthen it because he believes that the English are going to come back, and so the Mississippi River Valley becomes a target. And he sends Harrison to Vincennes, who sets up shop there to begin negotiate treaties, in a sense almost hopscotching what would become Indiana Some of the territory along the Ohio is ceded early, but Illinois, the Illinois Territory, the French territory of Illinois, and the tribal territory of Illinois becomes a target to begin to negotiate those treaties to secure the territory of the United States.
We look back quite often on these this time and with a different viewpoint, I think, a modern viewpoint. How did people back then view the treatment of Native Americans who were here? I mean, can you gauge that from what you've read?
There's one piece that comes to mind in particular. After Tippecanoe is lost in 1811, November of 1811, Ninian Edwards, the territorial governor of Illinois, is headquartered in Kaskaskia, and many of the tribes move to Lake Peoria. There's a gentleman there named Gomo, a leader of the Potawatomi. Gomo and his brother, Snetchwine, were orphaned and raised by a French couple. French Peoria is still really a French community. Edward sends emissaries up to Gomo's village, and Gomo gives a soliloquy about who they are and what they desire. And it is a moving and riveting commentary about recognizing how important their way of life is and noting that they have many friends in the settlement community who have treated them well, but also reacting to the fact that there are many who have not. On the other side of the coin, Edward's worry is that young men wanting to establish themselves within the Native American community are raiding some of the farms and settlers along the settlement line, if you will, in southern Illinois, causing great alarm that of insecurities. So you have this dynamic tension of people who are getting along, people who are not getting along, a government who is trying to balance their interests. It is a negotiating complexity that none of them are able to really secure without loss of dignity on one side or the other.
So when we look now more than 200 years since Illinois became a state, relations with Native Americans in the state, have we begun to make some type of, I don't want to call it reparation, but maybe, you know, what's your thoughts on that as somebody who studied this?
I think we're at a dawn of real enlightenment. This begins with a piece of legislation in 1990 called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Effectively, what it requires museums to do are to inventory human remains and mortuary objects, objects found in graves of Native people, and other objects that may be considered sacred, to notify the tribes and to encourage a conversation between the tribes and the museum community to begin with. It is a slow and painstaking process. It wasn't moving fast enough, so there have been changes in the regulations. But today, the dialogue between tribes and museums and universities and other organizations has reached a new level of engagement. It isn't quite yet the Venn diagram that you'd expect there to be overlap in viewpoints, and it's understandable. It's been sort of a polarity. But the fact that Logan Pappenford is the acting director of Dixon Mounds Museum is an indication of profound change and important change, and provides the opportunity for Native people to have their voice, and even to the point where I understand now there's some legislation to retain territory within Illinois. So I don't know how we ever balance the scale of this significant problem, but the only way to begin it is through conversation, and those have begun.
Michael, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Sean, for the opportunity.
Michael Wyant is Director Emeritus at the Illinois State Museum Dixon Mounds. He'll be speaking at an Illinois State Historical Society symposium in Springfield on December 3rd, which marks the 206th anniversary of Illinois statehood. You can find more details about the event on our show page. Illinois legislators are debating how to stop drugs from getting into state prisons, Mawa Iqbal reports.
The union representing prison workers says drug use in prisons has exploded. Republican lawmakers want to ban incoming paper mail because it's being soaked in synthetic drugs and fentanyl. State Representative David Fries says all mail should be scanned, then accessed digitally.
While we all have valued the connections that physical mail provides, it's hard to ignore the very real risk to safety that comes with it right now.
But Democrats like State Representative Kelly Cassidy say not so fast.
The answer to drug abuse is treatment, not more policing.
The Illinois Department of Corrections didn't immediately comment on the proposal. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Well, the election is now in the rearview mirror, but people are still trying to figure out exactly what happened. And we've been talking to some reporters about it. One of those, Scott Reeder with the Illinois Times in Springfield, is here to give his thoughts. Scott, thanks for taking time to speak with us. So let me just ask you to start with 2 weeks after the election. We know the outcome. What are some of your takeaways from what happened?
Well, I think it was interesting. I mean, we saw very little change in the makeup of the legislature. I mean, most of the seats, let's face it, are kind of baked in based on the maps that were drawn by the majority number of years ago. It's very hard for the minority party to make much in the way of gains because of that. What I found interesting is Donald Trump really improved on his standing in Illinois, despite it being a very blue state. His numbers went way up.
And, of course, right here in Sangamon County, he actually won the county. That's not surprising, I guess, but his success in other parts of Illinois, including Chicago, I think surprised a lot of people. Did it surprise you?
Yeah. He actually carried some wards in Chicago, which, you know, is pretty hard for a Republican of any stripe to do. That surprised me. I mean, in Sangamon County, he outpolled his national average. There's some things there that are kind of raise your eyebrows a little bit.
Do you see this as a one-off type of election, or do you see this as some bigger trend that's out there? A lot of people are wondering, is the nation becoming more conservative? What is your thought on that?
I wouldn't use the term conservative, but I don't think it's a one-off either. I think our nation's becoming more populist. I think that they're becoming more and more responsive to what I would call the anger politics. I also think there's a pushback against the perception of elitism among Democrats. I mean, there hasn't been a Democrat that's won the presidency in 50 years that wasn't a lawyer. There's kind of perception that maybe that they are too highbrow for the working person. I don't know if I buy that. We're talking about perception, not necessarily reality, but that's...
And there's certainly been a bit of a pushback on what some people call woke politics, but do you think that Democrats have to take a closer look at their platform going forward? Is that a takeaway from this election?
Yeah. I was talking to Sherry Bustos, who's a former congressperson from Illinois. We also were reporters together way back in the dark ages for 10 years, and we're chatting about it, and she said, you know, what they really need to do is reassess how they go about reaching ordinary people. There's a perception of elitism out there, whether it's real or not. It needs to be addressed. And, you know, Bill Clinton was wonderful at addressing and feeling empathy for ordinary Americans. Others, not so much.
Well, one of the things I have to ask you about, because it's come up from a lot of people, is J.B. Pritzker. What is his political future? Most people think he's going to run for another term as governor, but beyond that, he certainly has national aspirations. In the wake of this election and how bad things turned out for Democrats, do you think he suddenly is a name that is on a lot of people's minds when it comes to the next nominee?
I have seen his name in a lot of published national articles as a potential Democrat standard bearer for president in 4 years. I've seen, you know, other names as well, like Josh Shapiro out of Pennsylvania and a lot of things. You got to remember right now with Republicans holding the Senate and the House and the presidency, I think they're going to do a lot of looking to the states to find leadership to run for national office. And Democratic governors are a logical place to look.
Scott Reeder is a reporter for the Illinois Times. We've got more to come on Statewide.
This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois lawmakers will soon get to work on a new state budget. They have a multi-billion dollar deficit to try to solve. Republican State Senator Sally Turner represents much of rural central Illinois between Springfield, Decatur, and Bloomington. Turner served on the Senate's budget negotiating team this year and said she hopes to do so again. In this interview with Eric Stock, Turner says she and many of her colleagues are still in the dark about how some state money is being spent.
I'm first of all hopeful that we can get together earlier. As you know, it seems like it's a last minute at the end of the session that we're looking at the budget, and it's a quick drop. I'd like to see us get together earlier and to hammer away at all the different things that we can evaluate and talk to our different agencies and directors to figure out how we can better serve the public with less amount of money.
How early would you like to see?
I'd like to see us start when we come back in January, the third week of January. I'd like to see us start with who's going to be on those committees and things of that nature, and then reach out to those different departments and start working with them.
What is your reaction to the Governor's Office of Management and Budget projecting a $3.2 billion deficit for the coming fiscal year starting July 1st?
Frightening, isn't it? We've been talking for the last several years about how when the federal funds are going to dry up, that some of those permanent different avenues that they put the money into, such as new programs and things of that nature, they made those permanent, and then there's not going to be any money to be able to supplement those with state money. So that's something that I think that really needs to hone in on, and we know that's going to happen. Other things I think we need to look at, we've spent over $1 billion already on non-citizens. That's something I think that needs to be looked in more depth. We don't know exactly how much more is being spent. So you probably know we did a bill for transparency that was in the spring. And, I think that'd be a great idea to be able to just be transparent so we can find out where it is all going and how much. I think that's important for a new budget.
Can this gap be filled entirely through spending cuts? Or are there revenue increases that you would support?
No revenue increases. I'm hopeful that we can go back to having a good balanced budget and not one that's on the backs of the taxpayers.
What you've recommended doesn't add up to $3.2 billion. Are there other places where you would recommend cutting?
Well, first of all, I don't know that we know how much because we don't have that transparency. So we need to look at everything to make sure that we know where money goes and what funds it comes out of. And I think that's important. You know, we can edge away at things one by one, but I think that's what a good budget committee would do. Go through line items one by one and try and figure out how to come up with those without cutting services and without increasing taxes.
As we continue with State Senator Sally Turner, Illinois voters have weighed in on three non-binding ballot measures. 60% of voters said yes to an additional 3% income tax surcharge beyond $1 million in income, and that it could be used to offset property taxes. Do you expect lawmakers will move on this, and what would you like to see?
Well, first of all, it's really a vague statement. I will say this, as a former county clerk, it didn't tell me how it was going to change real estate taxes, and that's something that I did was tax extension. So it was vague, but I will say regarding going from a flat tax to a progressive tax, we'd have to change the Constitution. And our legal staff has told us that is something that has to be done if you want to make that change. Also, I believe in 2020, it was on the ballot, of course, for to have a progressive tax, and it was voted down by a great margin. So I think it looks like maybe our constituency doesn't want that to happen.
Do you expect lawmakers to do something with this, to bring forth something in the spring?
Right now, I don't. And one of the reasons I don't is because that, like I said earlier in 2020, that it was voted down. So, you know, that's a mix. So, you know, we'll wait and see what they decide to do. It's usually not up to me to put things on the agenda. So
do you think it signifies something that 4 years ago they voted again, they said no to this, and 4 years later they want it?
I think what it signifies, Eric, overall, is that the people of Illinois are having a really rough time. And they're having a rough time because they can't afford their groceries, they can't afford their gas, they can't afford their electricity. And every day they're tapping it. If they had a savings account, there isn't one left. So I think that's what most people are seeing. I don't think they want to be taxed more. I think they just want to have some relief.
89% had voted yes to civil penalties for interfering with election workers' official duties, and also 72% backed the state requiring insurers to cover in vitro fertilization and other reproductive treatments. Do you expect anything to come of either of these proposals?
Let's take one at a time. The first one regarding the election workers. Again, I'm a former county clerk, and I respect everything that our election workers do. It is difficult to get enough election judges the way it is, and every protection that's given to them, I greatly appreciate and I would support. The other one about the women's health issue, again, really vague as to what exactly it means. But I will say that the one statement that was in there about IBF, I supported that in the spring, and I voted on that. And the other portion of it, I guess, is that Illinois already has the most liberal and progressive ideas for in legislation right now. So they're well protected. All the women are well protected in Illinois.
And also, as we continue with State Senator Sally Turner, the State Senate Executive Committee has delayed a ban on carbon capture technology near aquifers, what has been a sensitive issue, especially here in McLean County in central Illinois, where many communities access the Mahomet Aquifer for their water supply. The committee said it wanted to learn more about the technology to feel comfortable with that ban. Do you want to see a ban approved?
Absolutely. So I was in that executive hearing, which I was glad that I was, so that I could listen to that extensive discussion. And I am a chief co-sponsor of Senator Faraci's bill to stop that. And I think it was important that we heard that the president of the Senate did mention that he thinks it needs a lot more work. Instead of it being a disagreement, they need to come to some kind of idea of how that can work to help the environment, but yet not drill holes through the aquifer, because that just can't happen. Our water, our sources are way too valuable. And the aquifer is all throughout my district. And we are very protective over our water source. And I think there's every reason why to be like that. And that's our life. If we didn't have water, we can't live. So that's very, very frightening. So I hope that Senator Faraci's bill just is able to be called again and passes.
Is there a certain language in there that you would support if they modified in some way, since it looks like that's what they might end up doing?
I would support nothing that goes through the aquifer.
Do you see a way that this technology would be acceptable to you if it does not impact the water supply at all? Or is it specifically about the aquifer that has you concerned about carbon capture?
Yeah, it's specifically about the aquifer. I think Senator Faraci brought up in that executive hearing, he brought up two places in Mattoon and I think in Tuscola that were doing that. And he was actually wondering, well, why can't they do it like they're doing it? And you don't go through the aquifer. Aren't there other places that you could do that? So anyway, I appreciate him bringing those up, that there are alternatives to that. But nope, we don't want it in our water supply.
Do you anticipate that when the when the moratorium is lifted in 2 years that we will see carbon CO2 pipelines in Illinois?
I don't know. I can't look into the future to see what's going to happen, but I'm hopeful that whatever happens, that no one drills through our aquifer.
That's Republican State Senator Sally Turner, and she spoke with Eric Stock. It's that time of the year when people eat a lot of pumpkin, pumpkin pie, pumpkin bread, even pumpkin ice cream. Most of the pumpkin that goes into those treats comes from the central Illinois town of Morton. In fact, in any given year, up to 95% of the canned pumpkin in the U.S. comes from the area. Joe Deacon gives us a look into how the popular crop figures into the local economy.
On a cool and breezy fall morning, John Ackerman surveys the pumpkin crop on his farm field just east of Morton.
It's been a good year for us. You know, normally pumpkins like it relatively dry. I've been amazed at how great this year was for pumpkins.
Ackerman's 30-acre farm has been in his family since 1909, originally focused on livestock, small grains, and row crops. In the 80s, he shifted the primary interest to pumpkins when he was first contracted by the nearby Libby's plant in Morton, a village that has embraced an identity as pumpkin capital of the world.
As soon as you start raising pumpkins, you fall in love with them. It's a great way of life.
Farms in this part of the country are well known for growing corn and soybeans. But in Morton and around Peoria, there's an emphasis on foods people serve during the holidays, especially pumpkins.
It's a great story to tell. You know, one of my colleagues once said, Thanksgiving is brought to you by Greater Peoria.
That's Chris Setti, the CEO of the Greater Peoria Economic Development Council. According to their figures, the Peoria region produces more than 220,000 tons of pumpkin each year. And a big reason for that is the Libby's plant. Rochelle Malin is with Nestle, Libby's parent company.
Over the last 16 years, we've harvested over 1.9 million tons of pumpkins. And then just last year, Libby sold enough cans in grocery stores to bake over 48 million pumpkin pies.
Malin says more than 90% of Libby's pumpkins are grown within a 45-mile radius of the facility, allowing them to establish a partnership with their farmers through the entire process. She says they help growers identify the best fields for their pumpkins.
Then Nestle provides our proprietary pumpkin seed and offers technical assistance during the planting. Once the seeds are planted, the ag team works with growers to continuously monitor that soil health, climate, and our pumpkins throughout the growing season and harvest.
Malin says these unique partnerships allow them to explore more environmentally friendly practices, such as cover crops and precise fertilizer application to improve soil quality. And Illinois' soil and climate is ideal for growing pumpkins. Mohamed Babadoust is a professor of plant pathology at the University of Illinois who specializes in vegetable and fruit crops. He says pumpkins have a huge impact on the state's agricultural economy.
In Illinois, we grow at least three times more pumpkin than any other state. One time I calculated pumpkin industry in my calculation is over $200 million industry in Illinois.
In Morton, they're very aware that the town is the heart of that industry. The village holds an annual pumpkin festival, which attracts 75,000 people over 4 days each September. Mayor Jeff Kaufman says pumpkin is just about everything in Morton.
Next year, Libby's will be in Morton for 100 years. So it's very important. I mean, they have 200 employees when they're canning and everything, and they support our stores and shops, gas stations.
Kaufman says almost anywhere you look in Morton, you'll see some sort of pumpkin depiction.
Just painted our water tower, a new logo, and the very next day I was already hearing compliments, and I had one lady demanded the other one get painted. I said, well, we're going to let the paint, you know, wear out just a little bit more.
Back at Ackerman's farm, they handpick roughly 30,000 pumpkins each year. For several weeks each fall, visitors flock to his farm stand to choose the perfect pumpkin from among 160 different varieties.
There's something iconically beautiful about looking over a pumpkin field when they're ripe, and it just shows the fruits of your labor.
As he looks out over his field of orange, white, and yellow pumpkins, Ackerman says the farm will continue to be a busy place as Thanksgiving approaches. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Joe Deacon.
We're out of time for Statewide. Be sure to join us again next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. In the meantime, you can find all of our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. Crawford, Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.